Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mr. Barton Maths Podcast with me, Craig Barton, a show where I interview people who interest and inspire me from the wonderful world of education. This is another in the series of my monthly conversations with my good friend and podcasting rival, the fantastic Ollie Lovell. And it's a very special episode because this is the 12th in our series of monthly conversations, which means we've been going for a year, so happy birthday to us. You know how it works by now. Each month we reflect upon three things that we've each been thinking about or experimenting with over the course of the previous month. I really enjoy doing these with Ollie. He's a great person to bounce ideas off. I always come away fully stimulated, and I hope people enjoy these monthly conversations too. We had a chat off mic, and we're happy to keep these going as long as people keep listening. So as long as you're finding it useful and we're finding it useful, we shall continue. So what did we discuss this time around? Well, six things. Ollie wanted to discuss how to respond to the do now. Quite an interesting one, that one. Then I pitched my new favourite thing in the whole wide world, NPPPN. Ollie then discusses his visit to a high-performing school. We then discussed how pedagogy changes or doesn't change at A level. We then talk about words to avoid when giving feedback to colleagues. And finally, a new idea, triple example problem pairs. Just a reminder, if you haven't already, to sign up to my two free weekly newsletters. That's the Tips for Teachers newsletter and the ED newsletter for more educational goodness in your inboxes each week. Links to those are in the show notes. Enjoy the show. Ollie Lovell, how are you, mate?
Well, crap. Pretty well. How about you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. Now, remember, last time we spoke, you weren't so good. So are you over your illness now?
Yeah, well, it's actually really knocked me around. So I've got a Garmin watch, which tells me my heart rate variability, which is like a good measure of recovery. And it was sitting in around 70 or 80s, the higher the number, the better, for like quite a while. And when I got sick, it got down to like the 30s, and it basically stayed in the 30s and 40s for about a month. And it's only been the last few days that it's kind of climbed back up. So it really knocked me around. I found it quite hard to like focus on work and things like that for the past month, but I'm on the mend now. So that's good.
Jeez. Hey, so I'm Garmin as well. So I track that, and I had a stag do weekend before last. So I'm best man for one of my friends at uni's upcoming wedding. So it was 2 days of drinking nonstop and blah, blah. And it's scary, right? If you have any alcohol and you look at your heart rate variability, it's horrendous. So mine was down to like 21 or something like that. I was essentially flatlining. I thought this is the end of me. But yeah, mine's snuck up back to the 80s, 90s now. So yeah, I'm all right. Hey, I'll tell you what I was going to say to you, mate. So at the time of recording yesterday, I've broken Australia. So I'm now the next big thing in Australia. So I've done this Think Forward Australia webinar thing, right? I've got a quote for you here, right? So the comments are coming in afterwards. Craig Barton is a gift to humanity. Now, what do you make of that?
What did you have to pay them, mate?
I mean, that's just the norm. So I've told my wife that I'm officially a gift to humanity now.
That's
so
good.
I'm loving the Aussies. I'm loving your lot.
Well, that's good, because we did talk about you potentially coming over here next year sometime for a little bit of an Aussie tour. We could do some stuff together. So I'm glad you've cracked the market, mate.
Gift to humanity. There you go. Right.
Well, I did one. I did one last Wednesday, I think, for Think Forward Educators, and no one called me a gift to humanity, mate. So You've done exceptionally well there. So that's particularly interesting, because I know that you said the bonus question you wanted to discuss today is how you take feedback. And I interpreted that as, you know, if you get feedback that's bad, but clearly you're just looking for advice about how to keep your head from exploding.
Well, I wish. So as a little teaser, Bruno Reddy, who listeners of the podcast may be aware of, kind of Times Table Rockstars guru and so on, he was in the session and he tweeted out a photo from the session My session was on checking for listening, and people were piling in, slagging me off left, right, and center. And it's the first time for a while that's happened, simply because I don't post a lot on Twitter for that very reason. But yeah, I had to kind of deal with a few demons. So I thought that'd be an interesting thing to reflect on, how we both respond to negative feedback or criticism. So we'll talk about that at the end of the show. Right, so let's dive in. Also, listeners know by now the format of this. Ollie and I each share three ideas we've been thinking about or experimenting with over the course of the last month or so. Ollie, what's your first idea you've got for us today?
I wanted to talk to you today, Craig, about methods for going through responses from starters, because this is something that I've kind of changed over the years, and I kind of saw, I came across one person, I think it was Pratesh's approach to doing it recently when I was watching some footage from his lesson. And it got me thinking about it. So I thought I'd talk through maybe some of the few different ways that I've approached it in the past, talk about some current thoughts, and I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on it, Craig. So, you know, when we're going through a starter, the answers from a starter, we want to be able to do it quickly. You know, we don't want to spend 15 minutes like going through it. We want to ideally kind of focus on a few key points, I would say. And ideally, we also want to give students something to concretely do with the feedback. Now, I'm not going to say that the things I'm suggesting here necessarily cover off all those, but I'd say that's the goal. And that kind of ties into Michael Pershing's got a great take on how feedback works. Shared this on my podcast, might have shared it on yours as well, Craig. But he says that, you know, feedback works when students either learn something new or they're motivated to learn something new. So that's what we need to do with our feedback. So I just thought that was kind of a nice little framing up. So some of the iterations, I'd say the first way that I used to kind of go through the responses or go through answers for a starter was simply just to work through every answer quickly. Just be like, okay, here's how to do it. And, you know, problem with that is it takes a long time and you're not kind of using that time effectively on the question that students really need help with. I think from there, I moved to something along the lines of kind of circulating and trying to get a sense of what students were struggling with and then addressing those few questions that I thought particularly needed some attention. From there, I moved to kind of mini whiteboards with the answer approach. I might have talked to you about this before, Craig, but it's like you get students to do the starter actually on a sheet of paper or in their book or something, and then you just say, okay, question one, what's your answer? Mini whiteboard, bang. Okay, down, and you just get a sense of what they needed to work on from that. Recently, I've been thinking about potentially doing it slightly differently. Now, this approach would only work if you had a really strong culture of error in your classroom, and students were really willing to, put themselves out there for help when they were struggling. But it, you know, I think iteration three, the mini whiteboard approach that I just talked about, is actually really strong and really effective. But if you do have the culture of error, I was thinking something like, you know, if you were to quickly just read out the actual answers, not the full solutions, but just say question one, three, question two, four and a half, whatever it might be, then give students a couple of minutes. So ideally the students are like either ticking or writing down the correct answer. Then actually just give them a couple of minutes to look through the questions and think about the ones that they got incorrect and think if they can work out what it was that they did incorrectly and therefore they needed to, what they would have needed to do to get to the correct answer. Because, you know, rather than just the teacher launching into, you got this incorrect, this is what you should have done instead, I thought maybe you're giving them a pause to really have a think, you know, oh, okay, that's the answer. I know I made a mistake here. You know, what was my mistake? And then do hands up for questions after that. You know, based upon that, if you just had two minutes to think about it, anything you want me to go through following that, I thought could be an interesting or powerful protocol. Again, only if you kind of got that culture of error in the classroom, and also if students have enough kind of self-awareness and self-regulation to actually be able to tell when they do understand something and when they don't, which is probably a bit of a longer journey. But yeah, just something I've been thinking about a little bit the last few weeks, Craig, and I wanted to run it past you.
Oh, I'm glad you've chose this all. So I'm obsessed with the start of lessons. As listeners know, and you know, when I visit a school to offer support, it's often the first thing we work on as a department, because if you get the start of that lesson right, it can bleed through to the rest of the lesson, both from the student side and the teacher side, right? Like, so if the students get like a real high quality start to that lesson where they're participating, they're thinking and so on. That bleeds through. But also, I think the underrated thing is, if the teacher gets the pedagogy right at the start of the lesson, in terms of getting mass participation, responding accordingly and so on, that can bleed through as well. So it's a really good phase of the lesson, I think, to think about as individual teachers and departments. So a few thoughts. I massively agree with you on the technique of starter in books, transfer final answer to mini whiteboard. So I call this book to board. And I think that simple tweak is a bit of a game changer because it stops. This goes back to what we talked about last time. A mistake I think teachers make is they spend just as long on questions that kids know how to do as they do on questions kids don't know how to do. And often that's because they don't have the data. So the teacher will model, if it's a four-question starter, they'll say, right, let's go through question one. So you do this, you do this, you do this. All the kids know how to do it. But because they haven't got that from the mini whiteboards, the teacher doesn't know. So yeah, I'm a big fan of that book-to-board approach. I really like that. A little tweak on that, Ol. In some schools I visit where... you can't really get the kids to focus for kind of 5, 6, 7 minutes at the start of the lesson. And the kids are just kind of essentially sat there waiting for the teacher to go through the answers. What a few teachers have experimented with that I've been coaching is doing one at a time. So once the kids come in, one question appears on the board. The kids have got 20 seconds to do it on their mini whiteboards, 3, 2, 1, show. And then the teacher responds accordingly. And then the next question comes on the board. It's not ideal in the sense that you lose that kind of independent focus time at the start. But for certain kids and for certain classes, they're much more cognitively active than they would be if you did it the other way around. So the kind of one at a time approach can work quite well there.
That's good. Just to add to really, that as well.
Say again, sorry, mate.
Yeah, yeah. Just to add to that, a tip I got off Lorraine Hammond, if you are doing questions like one at a time like that, she suggests having a couple. So you have like the base level question and you have like two more just for those kids who finish particularly quickly. And so the emphasis is on the first one. And the first one, if you're going to go through the answer, that's the one you go through. But then, you know, two and three are just for those kids who need a bit of an extra stretch. And you can say, and the answer to this one is this, and this, the answer to this one is this, and move on.
Love it. Love it. So a couple more final things on this. So mass participation is an absolute must, I think. I'm going to come to your tweak on this in a sec, Ol. But that's why, again, I'm mini whiteboards all the way for this. Speed is essential for this. As I say, you don't want it going on for probably more than 10 minutes. I think a good thing to aim for is 5 minutes for the kids doing the questions, 5 minutes in terms of the teacher responding accordingly to the answers. Related to that, and this is, I don't know whether it's controversial or not, I think all the do now or starter questions should be retrieval unrelated to the lesson content. A lot of teachers I see do kind of hybrid approaches to starters where it's a bit retrieval, but it's a bit prerequisite knowledge check as well. And the problem you've got with that is it can get a bit confusing in terms of how teachers respond to the data that comes from the kids. So my kind of rule of thumb is if, you know, 80% plus of the kids are showing you the right answer on the mini whiteboard, confirm the answer and move on. If it's less than 80%, model and then ask a follow-up question. And if the kids still don't get that follow-up question right, just move on, make a note of it, and then come back to this when you've got more time. But of course, you can't do that with prerequisite knowledge because you can't move on until you've hit that kind of 80, 90%. So if you're using a bit of prereq knowledge and a bit of retrieval in that do now, it's just that extra complication of thinking, ah, right, I need to respond slightly differently to this question than this question. So I much prefer a retrieval standalone do now, followed by a prereq knowledge check that kind of leads in into the lesson. But again, that's just a personal preference. Final three things I'll say. One of the main things with the do now is the kid should feel successful at the end of it. And I see lots of do nows where the pitch is so high, the kids feel crap at the end of it. And then you're trying to pick them up for the rest of the lesson. And again, there's interesting research that first question should be a really easy, accessible one to get the kids going. And also, if they're not responding, it must be due to a lack of effort, not a lack of understanding. So you get a bit of a diagnosis benefit there. But yeah, you want the kids to feel really good about themselves at the end of that 10 minutes. So sometimes lowering that pitch a little bit, I think is quite a sensible thing to do. We have a big problem in the UK, I don't know if you have in Oz, and with late arrivals, so kids rocking in like 6-7 minutes late. So thinking about the do now there when they come in, and there's 2 minutes to go before you start going through the answers. Do you ask them to start on question one? Do you ask them to start on question two? So again, just thinking about later arrivals, they can often scupper the do now. But the final thing, and this circles back to your tweak there, Al, I think one important thing of the do now is to set the tone for the rest of the lesson. And yours sounds like a really interesting way to get the kids taking a bit of responsibility for their own learning. As you say, having that culture in the class where there's no point in them hiding if they're confused. There's no point in them ticking wrong answers because nobody's bothered about it. It's all on them. So if you want to set the tone for your lesson, that in this lesson we take responsibility for our own learning. If we're struggling, we ask questions, we help each other out, and we think from the very first minute, then I really like that because that's all encapsulated in your way of doing the do now. And I think the way I do it, as I say, with the book to board and so on and so forth, I think is great. But it's very much on the teacher, all the emphasis is on the teacher taking in that data and responding accordingly, not on the kids. So if I want to set the tone for the lesson that actually a bit more emphasis is going on the kids here, I really like your tweet to that, Al.
Cool. And I think you'd probably need to do book to board for a while until students started to really see like, oh, this is really good. When Sir sees that we've struggled, he goes through it and he helps us with the stuff we struggle with. So we should probably be clear about what we're struggling with. So yeah, that could work too. You could also do like a heads down voting, like heads down, put your fingers up to indicate which question you need help with, if any question. If students are like a bit nervous to talk about that, and the teacher can say, okay, yep, a number of people said question five. Great, heads up again, let's go through that. So that could be another tweak to make that even easier.
That's good. Just a little aside here. So I was in a school, was it last week or something like that? And the do now was all over the show because they had a whole school policy where they had to have 5 questions, which I think is too many for a maths do now. I'm a big fan of 4. They had to have 5. Then they also had to have a literacy kind of just word kind of put in there that was supposed to be discussed. And as I said, this was whole school across all subjects. But it just wasn't working for math. So this what was really interesting about this literacy thing, so like a key word was just tagged on to the end of this slide. And it was almost doing the opposite of what it was supposed to be doing because the teacher wasn't bothering addressing it at all. But because it was there, I think there was almost this kind of implicit thought that, oh, well, I kind of have addressed it because it's visible to the kids and so on. So the teacher wasn't making a big deal of it at all. So I had a big conversation with the head teacher and the deputy head, and I said, I'm not sure this is working for maths. But they were very adamant that this is kind of a whole school thing. So I think the other thing just to say is, yeah, just make sure your do now is serving the purpose. And I, again, it's minor things. I wouldn't have the date. I wouldn't have the title on the screen. I'd just have those 4 questions. I wouldn't have the kids copying the questions out or anything like that. You want to remove all barriers and just get them focused on those 4 questions or whatever it is so they can get going straight away.
Good stuff, mate. What's your number one?
Yeah, so I've been looking forward to discussing this. Well, I've been looking forward to all 3 of these, you know. They've been on the back burner for a while, these. So I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to it. I know you don't listen to my stuff all, so I'm wasting my time here. But I interviewed Chris Bolton, maybe put out last week or something like that. Have you listened to this one yet?
No, I haven't actually. Yeah, I've been looking forward to it, though.
It's a good one because we've been teasing this for a while, right? We've essentially talked about his entire book over the last few episodes. And it's a great conversation. Nothing to do with me, like genuinely on him, because he's a fascinating guy. So for listeners who haven't listened to it, it's about his book he's writing called Unstoppable Learning. And at the heart of it is atomization, this idea of breaking down complex routines into individual atoms of knowledge and crucially teaching or assessing those atoms separately from the routine itself. And then the theory being, once those atoms are secure, put them together in the routine and students' attention can be on the order the atoms form the routine, or what Chris calls chaining, the chaining of the atoms, as opposed to having to think about the atoms itself. Now, I've been messing around with versions of this for about 6 or 7 years, but it's Chris's framework, that's the way he categorizes atoms and the way he deals with them, that's really got me excited. So I've been experimenting with this over the last few weeks. and the big idea that I wanted to share with you all, and I think it's going to change your life, so make sure you're kind of strapped in for this, is this idea of NPPPN. So you've got an N, three P's, and an N, right? And this is my new obsession. So this is the sequencing of examples and non-examples for teaching what Chris would call categorical atoms, okay? So a category is anything that you can ask the question, is this a, and the answer will be yes or no. So a classic example will be, is this a prism? Yes or no. Or is this a quadratic equation? Yes or no. Or you could go a bit fancier, would I use Pythagoras to solve this question? Yes or no. So it's always a positive or negative response. Now, what's really interesting about Chris's approach here is, one, there's three components to successful atomization. So the first is taking a routine and breaking it down into its atoms. And I think that's hard. So when you've got a worked example, thinking, what are all the atoms of knowledge kids need? And that's hard. And it takes practice. And there's little techniques you can use, but it's a hard thing to do. Once you've listed the atoms, the next thing you do is categorize the atoms. So is this a categorical atom, like the ones I've been talking about here? Is it a transformation atom, something we'll perhaps touch on in another week? Is it a comparative atom, and so on? That's quite easy to do, the categorization. And the point Chris makes is, you can get into endless debates. Is it this? Is it that? It doesn't matter too much. Okay, but then the nice bit is, once you've done that, that's all your hard work done. Because once you know, for example, that an atom is a category atom, there's a predefined way of teaching it. And the way to teach category atoms is NPPPN. So you don't have to spend then all your time agonizing over, how many examples should I do? Should I start with a non-example? Should I do this? It's all there for you. So this NPPPN sequence is, you start with a non-example, and I find that the most interesting thing. And when I've been talking to teachers about this, they often find that surprising. So when you're teaching kids let's go boring for now. When you're teaching kids what a prism is, you start by showing them something that isn't a prism. And that catches them by surprise, catches them a bit off guard. And then what you do is you make a minimal change to generate your positive example. So the NP is, you start with a non-example, then it's a minimal change to get a positive example. So you change one critical feature of your non-example and it generates a positive example. Now, what I find interesting about this is, most of your work is done there, you know. If you've identified a really important critical feature and you've gone from non-example to positive example, varying that one thing, the kids have pretty much got it. I'd say you're 80% of the way there. But to get you 100% of the way there, your next positive example is a maximally different one. So what you're doing then is, you want to, over the course of the next two examples, you want to show kids the breadth of this concept. And Chris has a really nice diagram in the book where he says, if you just do kind of three bog standard kind of prototypical examples, we talked about prototypical examples last time, then kids don't know how wide this concept is. So Chris has this diagram of a circle, and then the three positive examples are like round the center of the circle. But if you do maximally different ones, then your positive examples are right on the boundary towards the edge of the circle. And Chris says that what we do as learners there is, we infer that everything that isn't quite as different as our maximally different one must also remain inside the category. So you do a bit of inference from that. So just to recap, we've got a non-example, a minimally different positive, then you go two maximally different positives to get to the boundaries. And then to bring it home, you change your fourth example, or your third positive example, that third P, you do a minimally different change to make it a non-example. So what you've got there, the purpose of the maximally different positives is to show kids the breadth of the concept. The purpose of the minimally different changes between positive to negative, between examples 1 and 2 and 4 and 5, is to define to kids where the boundary is. Where's the boundary of this concept? And again, kids infer that if you've tipped over the other side of the boundary, anything more extreme than that will also not be an example as well. So there's a few things I like about this, and then I'll shut up and hand it over to you. I like a structure. You love a structure too. It's just, again, it's just one less thing for me to think about. So all my attention can be going on to this sequence as opposed to worrying about the number and the order and so on. But the thing I love most about this is it's that classic creativity amidst constraints concept that if I look back at my previous attempts at this, they'd be like 12 examples long, 13 examples long. I'm trying to get everything in there. Whereas if I know I've only got 5 examples to play with, it really focuses me on what's the most important things to bring out. And sure, sometimes I'll have to chuck in a 6th example. Sometimes I'll have to end with an extra negative and so on if there's one real critical feature that I need. But it's drastically reduced the number of examples I use. And that means I can get through most of these sequences less than a minute, I'd say, because I don't have to do a lot of talking because the examples are doing the talking. Sometimes I draw kids' attention to the critical thing, but I don't have to do much of it. And then you get onto the testing sequence. And then you spend all the time that you've saved just giving kids so many examples, and they're holding up mini whiteboards or saying thumb up, thumb down, yes, no, and so on. And that's when you're getting your data back to see whether your sequence of 5 has done the job. So within a minute or 80 seconds, the kids have pretty much got it. And then you're just firing the craziest examples at them in the world, and they're nailing it every single time. So the final thing to say about this all, then I'll shut up and hand over to you, is Chris makes the important distinction between using language to explain one of these categories and actually being able to just identify things that are in this category and out of this category. So Chris uses an example in his book that he had a bottom set year 7, and he used this sequence, NPPPN, to teach them what a prism was and what a prism wasn't. By the end of it, every child in this class, you could give them any shape in the whole wide world, and they'd be able to tell you, almost with 100% accuracy, whether it was a prism or not. Could they use the language? Could they say things about the plane face and constant cross-section? No, they couldn't. And Chris's point that he makes is that we often rely on language to communicate things when it's much clearer to use these examples and non-examples, and the language can come later. It's the least important part of this whole process. So I love this. I'm a bit obsessed with this, but as I say, I've rattled on too long there. What do you make of this all?
Yeah, that's super interesting, Craig. This is the great thing that Chris is doing at the moment. He's basically making understandable and interpretable the absolute gold that is locked away in this theory of instruction book by Siegfried Engelmann. Because, and a lot of people don't realize this is exactly what Engelmann did. He basically worked out how to categorize knowledge into all these different categories, you know, such as categorical knowledge. And then he derived extremely efficient ways to teach each of these types of knowledge. And the fact that this stuff isn't widely known in a world where like teaching and communication is absolutely paramount is like, it's an absolute loss to humanity in contrast to yourself, Craig, being the God's gift to humanity. Because it's like this stuff, this is what you've just shown us is like the tip of the iceberg of the knowledge that Siegfried Engelmann has codified for the world. So it's awesome that Chris is unlocking this. It's a project that I wanted to do myself and may still do myself. But I think Chris is probably going to beat me to that one as well. But that's great because he sounds like he's doing a great job of it. One thing I wasn't so. I get the first non-example. I get how it gets to the second positive example. I missed. And I got how the final positive example moves to the non-example. I missed like, I don't know, I'm not entirely sure about those 3 P's in the middle. I'm not sure if that was just me or other people as well.
Yeah, so the idea, so the first P or example 2, you're happy that's a minimal difference from the first yeah. non-example.
And therefore shows like the lower bound of the concept or so it's called
so you've
lower
established
bound.
The boundary. You've established yep. the boundary straight away. Mm-hmm. The key thing there is with the next 2 examples, you want to show how wide, how broad this concept is. So you mm-hmm. want to try and find examples towards the edge of other boundaries, if that makes sense. So again, if you picture a circle, your first non-example and positive example may be on the boundary towards the top of that circle. But now you want to show kids where the other boundaries go. So if you do a maximally different example that's perhaps, you know, bottom left of the circle, well, now kids can see, oh, actually, this is a lot broader than I thought it was. And now let's whiz over to another section of the circle and show them another maximally different positive example. And then let's tweak that maximally different one to get a minimally different negative to show them where the boundary is. So it's about trying to show them how broad. So if I give you a concrete example of this, with quadratic equations, you may start out with a linear equation, might be a non-example, and then you may introduce an x squared term to generate your minimally different positive example. But then you want to show kids that these quadratic equations can get really crazy. And as long as the highest power of your variable is 2, you're laughing. So you may chuck the x squared term on the right hand side of the equal sign. You may have a crazy coefficient, a fractional coefficient. You may have 2x squareds. You may have a y squared instead of x squared. You want to show them that you can do a load of crazy things with this, but that as long as that critical feature is still present, you're still there. So that's the idea of those kind of three P's in the middle. They're to show maximally different positive examples so kids realize just how broad this is. And then you just refine it with that final minimally different negative example to just define the boundary, if that makes a bit more sense.
Mm. Yeah, I guess the only confusing thing is that three P's would always be sufficient to show the range of the concept. I guess this requires that it's contingent upon the initial atomization of the content such that there's not too much variation within it. I mean, yeah, dog would be tricky. Like, you know, is this or isn't this a dog? Like, that's, I'm trying to think, because there's so many different variations you can have. Maybe three P's wouldn't be sufficient, so we need to atomize things more. I'm not sure.
Well, dog's an interest. So Chris uses the dog one in his book. Dog's really interesting, right? And the general point with this is you never know till you try it. So it's only, and Chris again makes this point throughout the book, if it works, it works. If it works, it's a good sequence. If your kids can come out of it and then you can throw them any example and they get it right, almost by definition, you've done your job. So when he talks about dog, he makes the point in the book that, again, you could show kids 100 dogs, but until they see a wolf and they're told it's not a dog, they're screwed. So you want to start, you probably start with wolf, transition to dog, and then you want some massive, fluffy, crazy dog. Then you want some little chihuahua yapping away or something like that, and so on. So you want to, and again, this is the challenge, right? Because you can always argue for more positive examples. But the danger with that is you end up with 7, 8, 9, 10 examples. If you force yourself just to try and get it within those three positives and see what happens, I've certainly found for efficiency, it's a bit of a game changer. It just means you can get the kids, you can get testing the kids much quicker. And again, they can make those key inferences. And if they can't, you tweak the sequence. But yeah, I try and force myself to try and do it in those three positives. The thing I find harder, to be honest with you, is limiting it to two non-examples. Because if something has more than two critical features, you've either got to do an extra non-example or you've got to try and gamble that kids are going to pick it up. And that's the bit I find harder. I often end up having to throw in an extra negative at the end.
Mm. No, it's super interesting. I could continue going back and forth about this, but I think I'll leave that for when I one day interview Chris about these important ideas. It's so interesting and I can't wait to dive into it more.
Yeah, and again, just as a little teaser, I'll be talking about how these ideas don't always go down a storm in my next takeaway. But that's keep listening, everybody. Right, over to you all. What have you got for us next?
So this Tuesday, I was lucky enough to visit the highest achieving secondary school in Victoria, which is the school that Greg Ashman is the deputy principal at, Ballarat Clarendon College. And basically, the purpose of my visit was to try and work out what it is on earth that they do that helps them to get phenomenal results. And their results are, like, to try to explain it in a universal way how good their results are, the kind of median mark that their students are getting has put them, you know, the top ranking school in Vic in, I think, 3 of the last 5 years. But, and the like how high that median rank is it's so high that even in the years when they're not the top school, other schools don't get the same height of median rank, right? Like, so they are just like achieving a level of success that even other schools in their best years can't achieve, you know, without explaining how our Victorian kind of grading system works. So it's really seriously impressive. So I was lucky enough to have the whole kind of the better part of a day there, visited probably about seven or so lessons or parts of lessons, was given time with the head of pretty much every department and the principal and Greg as well. Extremely grateful for the generosity of their time. And for me, like a few things came out that I feel were really the core ingredients. Now, obviously, there's many, many more things. And I'm going to have Greg on the podcast. Hopefully, I'll have Greg on the podcast soon to kind of dive into this in a little bit more detail. But three/four things really jumped out to me as things that have helped Ballarat Clarendon College to be as successful as it has been. The first is like a sustained professional learning focus. So I believe it was, they said that they first introduced Rosenshine's principles in like 2015. They're still running PD on Rosenshine's principles 9 years later, right? They have not jumped, chopped and changed. So there's like a few things like explicit instruction, formative assessment, Rosenshine, cognitive load theory. They've been focusing their PL around these four plus a few other select things for those 9 years and longer. And, you know, I think that's what it takes to get to a point such that, you know, when I'm talking to every head of department, they're actually talking the same language, they're talking about the same stuff, and they seem to have a pretty deep understanding of what they're actually talking about. And when you do get to that level of kind of depth of knowledge, like the transfer just starts to spontaneously happen, I think. It becomes, you know, that shared, as Gwynup Apari would call it, shared conceptual understanding is just so deep that it kind of makes its way through everything that the school does. So that's the first thing. And often we do kind of discount the amount of time it takes to build that depth of understanding. I think that was absolutely crucial. The second thing, and this is something we talk about a lot, Craig, is a prescriptive and a shared approach. So all teachers teaching off the same slides or slideshows. Now they haven't said that everyone has to use slideshows, or PowerPoints, but it just happens that every department's decided to use PowerPoints. But this was so prescriptive. There's a joke that in France, the French Minister of Education, you could say like it's 2 o'clock on a Tuesday or Thursday on the 9th of May, and they could say, okay, that means everyone's learning X, Y, Z. But like that's actually the case at Ballarat Clarendon College. I could be like, all right, this is the day, this is the lesson, what are your students learning? And they showed me, they'd pull up the shared drive and they'd say, this is the lesson that they'll be learning today. And, you know, you go to that class and lo and behold, that's what they're working on. With the small exception of teachers who are teaching like a year 12 subject and they're the only teacher of that subject, they can have a bit more flexibility and move around. So that's one thing. And that we combine with the idea of rigorous data use. So they started with using the external data from external exams to do kind of analysis and look at item by item analysis of what their students were doing well at and what they were struggling with. And now they've moved to a point where, you know, every assessment the students do, they do item by item analysis. They compare classes and then they say, okay, you know, four of these five classes got 80% on average on question three, but this fifth class got 90% on average. And then they have a chat with the teacher who got 90% and they say, what did you do differently? And the teacher shares. And then because they have the prescriptive and shared approach, they feed that, whatever that teacher did that was more successful, they feed it back and actually build into the lesson plan for the following year. And this facilitates, this is the 3/4 thing, the idea of a ratchet. So this facilitates a ratcheting up of incremental improvements through this cycle of kind of like professional learning leads to quality shared lessons, which are then analyzed through data, which then feeds back in a cycle to improve the lessons once again. And you just do this for a number of years in a structured and systematic way, and you just end up with phenomenal curriculum resources and a solid understanding of what quality pedagogy is. And you end up with really amazing outcomes. Now, there's other things they have, like these shared classroom expectations. They've got a list of about 15, I think, if I recall correctly, things that students are going to do in the classroom and that teachers are going to do. Things like, you know, at Ballarat Clarendon College, students don't raise their hand to answer questions. They raise their hand to ask questions, things like that. And so every teacher has to teach in line with those things. But yeah, I think to me, the encouraging thing about this is like none of this is rocket science either, right? But it's just really solid pedagogy, driven by evidence and done consistently over time without kind of shifting focus or being distracted by shiny things. So it was an awesome visit. I'm super grateful for it. And I feel like I learned a lot.
That's amazing. I'm jealous of you, you know. I need to, almost by definition, most of my time is spent in underperforming schools, right? Because that's who gets me in and so on. And this is going to sound a bit harsh. I don't know whether I should say this, but I've started it now, so it's going to come out my mouth. I'm getting bored is probably not the right word. Maybe frustrated is, because I'm just seeing the same things. Like I can almost predict what my day one and day two of support's going to be. Like the kids aren't going to be listening. The teacher's not going to be getting mass participation. The consistency of resources used is going to vary from room to room and so on. So I can almost map out what the first 1, 2, 3 days of support is. And then it gets interesting days, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 and so on. But I think I spoke to you actually. I visited a really high performing school fairly recently, Trinity Academy Leeds, and you just learn so much. And but also you come out, it's a bit heartbreaking because you can see what it could be like for all kids. As you say, none of this is, doesn't require millions of pounds, millions of dollars or anything. It's, yeah, it just requires everybody to get on board behind something. So that's really interesting. Yeah, I'm going to do this. I need to visit some more high-performing schools. And I've got one reflection, then 3 questions for you all. So the first reflection is the thing that stood out most to me there was, yeah, data informing improvements in the curriculum materials. You're right, that does not happen anywhere near as much as it should do. Like sometimes curriculum materials, well, sometimes schools don't have shared curriculum materials. If they do, they often just remain static or they just changed a bit ad hoc. They're certainly not changed in a systematic way like that. So that's brilliant. I absolutely love that. 3 questions for you all. You visited, when you were over in the UK, you visited some really high performing schools, right? You visited Michaela and so on. What commonalities did you see and what differences did you see?
The main thing I took away from my visits to schools in the UK was around... Well, the first thing to note is like the vibe at Ballarat Clarendon College is quite different to the vibe I felt at the high achieving UK schools, or English schools. You know, the high achieving English ones, there was a much more formal kind of rigorous vibe, and in some of them, I actually felt like some of the older students weren't super engaged. They were kind of going through the paces. The instruction was really good, but the kids were also feeling a bit like we've been doing the same kind of processes since like grade 7 or something. That was only in a couple of them. It wasn't across the board, but Ballarat, I didn't have that sense at all. And in fact, some of the lessons I saw, the students were like super into it, and this teacher could almost like was struggling to get them to stop asking like really good questions because they were like so into the learning and so excited about it. So that's, I guess, an initial kind of thing that's interesting, which leads into the main thing that I took away from the visit to those high-performing English schools, and that was like I didn't know what high standards meant, and I think I've said this to you before. I didn't know what high standards meant until I saw it in some of these schools that I visited in that trip a couple of years ago. I didn't know how closely students could listen to what a teacher was saying, or how quickly they could turn and talk and then snap back to an attention signal. And so I think, and this is something you talk about a lot, just like, the first thing is attention, and Adam Boxer as well. He would go into schools and it's like, why aren't students learning? Because they're not listening to the teacher. So if you can just move from a point where students aren't listening to the teacher to where they are listening to the teacher, you're going to get a lot of learning gains. And I guess that was, take it further. They are listening to the teacher, but they're really listening to the teacher. You're going to see a lot of change. So that was probably the big main thing that I took away there. And so there were, you know, things like norms of use of whiteboard use and things like that. I think probably behind the scenes and something I didn't see as much, but that was still there, was still the like high quality curriculum focus and just like really, really quality materials and resources. I don't know why I didn't look into that as much during my prior visits. Maybe I just wasn't at the same point in my understanding of what it takes to drive school improvement. But it would be interesting to know if they actually used the kind of data as a ratchet as well. So yeah, that's a few reflections.
That's great. That's great. Just two more things. So back to Greg's school, Al. Did you get a sense of, well, two parts really, staff turnover? Was there a lot of churn going on there? And like, how quickly could you get a new member of staff on board, like ready to teach in this way?
Yeah. So staff turnover, incredibly low. So I hope I've remembered this correctly, but the current principal started as a graduate teacher at this school.
Oh, nice.
Like, that is pretty unheard of. And generally the view is like, if you want to become the principal of a high performing private school, like you need to just like, you need to travel, you need to jump around 3 years here, 3 years there, get some runs on the board. For some reason, the school, well, I think it's because there's a huge focus on continuous professional learning. Like the teachers who go there don't feel like they, from my brief exposure to the school, and I hope I'm not talking out of turn on any point here, and I look forward to Greg correcting me in a couple of days, hopefully when we have our chat. But the sense I got and what I was told is they don't feel like they need to go elsewhere because they are learning so much. And also because once you work in a school where processes are so tight and working so well, I had multiple teachers say to me, like, I wouldn't survive anywhere else. Like, it, like, I just couldn't do it because I'd go there and that I'd be writing my own lessons from scratch and it would just seem like insanity to me, right? So when you have something that's that good, you know, you just recognize that it's that good and that you're achieving phenomenal results, and you would struggle to do it anywhere else. And so they've retained people, and again, that compounds that collective and shared conceptual understanding.
That's brilliant. And final question, Al. So I visit lots of schools where they have shared curriculum materials. So teacher in two different rooms will be teaching from the same PowerPoint and so on. But the pedagogy is vastly different. So one will be using whiteboards, one will be getting a bit of group work going, one will be going through the work, for example, asking the kids questions, one will be doing it in silence and so on. How consistent was the pedagogy that you saw in lessons? Was it just the curriculum materials that were defined and prescribed, or was the pedagogy as well?
So the pedagogy is actually built into the curriculum materials. So first thing is that overlay of those like Ballarat expectations, I can't remember what they were called, but those kind of 15 things that every teacher needs to do. So there's that overlay, and that includes things like mini whiteboards, etc., if I recall correctly. But then in the slides, it actually has like either images or text that says, this is a mini whiteboard question, things like that. You know, this is the check for understanding question. This is an I do question. This is a you do question. Crucial. And then something else that's come up in our discussions a lot, and which you may have been tempted to ask about as well, is, you know, how do you stop teachers from just kind of clicking through the slides? Right. And this was something we talked about a lot and that Greg talked about a lot. So the real expectation there is that, you know, teachers don't plan for lessons, but they do prepare for lessons. So they are, and, you know, I said, what does that look like? And they were like, okay, in maths, it means they do all the questions on the slides. They do them the day before or a couple of days before. In English, it means that they read through, they use like the presenter notes in their slideshows. The teacher will have read through all the presenter notes before the lesson. So they're actually pretty prescriptive about what it means. You know, you need to prepare for your lesson, and this is what it means to prepare for that lesson. And the other thing they do is they make sure that every lesson includes far more content than is realistic for the teacher to get through in that lesson. And what that means is that the teacher has multiple routes that they can take through the lesson based upon what actually happens in the checks for understanding. You know, we often talk about hinge questions, but often that term is used incorrect. A hinge question is actually a question that's used to determine the subsequent path that the teacher takes in the lesson. That is only possible if the teacher has other, like multiple paths that they can take from that hinge. If you know, you have a hinge question and the slideshow is just like lockstep following that, it's not actually a hinge question. It's just like a question. I mean, it is a check for understanding, but it's not used as a hinge. So they actually have hinge questions because they have slideshows that have 80, 90, 100 slides in them for a 70-minute period. And to me, that makes like so much sense.
I'm really looking forward to your conversation with Greg, actually. I've been meaning to get him back on my show for a while now. So I'll, see how he goes on you. And then, if you leave anything out, I'll swoop in and, do the leftovers. That sounds good.
Sounds right. Great. And we can get you a visit there when you come out in next year as well.
That'd be good. Right, I'll do my second one now. So this has been on my list to talk about for a while now, but two things have happened in the last 7 days that have bumped it to the top of the list. So my question to you all, and I'll pepper this with a bit of my own experiences, is how does pedagogy change when you're teaching senior students? So I'm talking A-level here. So I'm talking 17 and 18-year-olds. So for international listeners, the way it works in the UK, you do your GCSEs at age 16, and then you have two additional years where you select 3-4 subjects that you want to continue to study for your A-level exams 2 years later. My question to you is, for your equivalent, how does pedagogy differ when you're teaching those lessons compared to, say, a 15-year-old, a year 11 lesson, a year 10 lesson? Now, the reason I ask this is every A-level lesson I see is quite significantly different to a lesson with kids who are just 1 year younger than that in their last year of GCSEs. And when I reflect back on my teaching, when I was teaching full time and I had A-level classes, my pedagogy would be different as well. So here are a few observations. So the first is, I think, and this again, this is just usual disclaimers, just my take on this, blah, blah, blah. I think the content is broken down a bit less at A-level than it would be at GCSE. So if I told you a few days ago, I did a PD session on atomization with a group of A-level teachers, and a guy came up to me afterwards and says, this is all fine at GCSE, but that's ridiculous. You don't need to do that at A-level. You don't need to break it down in this way. So I thought that was quite an interesting observation. You almost invariably see, so I've been in an A-level college these last 2 days, and when the teachers are modelling, you invariably see kids copying down at the same time as the teacher's modelling, where often for younger students there's this idea of empty hands, eyes on me, and then the kind of copying down comes later. I think there's just a general feeling that the kids can cope with a bit more independent work. There's a lot more independent practice. I think a greater portion of the lesson is kind of set over to the kids kind of trying out things and muddling their way through, as opposed to it's probably a bit more guided, I think, for younger years. I think there's a little bit less emphasis on retrieval, the importance of retrieval. You don't often get the kind of quick fire 4 different question retrieval starters that perhaps you do get at lower age groups. Whiteboard use, often different as well. I think you often get, you don't see mini whiteboards at A-level, or sometimes they're used a little bit differently. And I'm just trying to think why this might be the case. I'm speaking to A-level teachers and reflecting myself. You often get things like, there's too much content to get through, so we can't break things down as much. We've just got to kind of crack on with it. That seems to be the case with the English A-level. You also get that the questions are kind of multi-step and multifaceted, so they don't lend themselves as well to kind of quick whiteboard checks or quick retrieval and so on and so forth. There's this idea that the kids are mature now. They've chosen this subject, so they should be more independent and so on, and kind of, you know, ready to struggle through. But the point with all this, of course, is they're still novices. They're still novices in the things that they're being taught. Just because the content's harder, you know, they still need that support and instruction throughout it. But yeah, it's, as I say, I just wondered your take on it all, because I know you've taught kind of all year groups as well. Just reflecting on your own pedagogy, would it be different with those senior students? And what do you think to some of those reflections?
Yeah, I almost think it's the opposite. I am probably more explicit. And I mean, I break things down in a more granular fashion for older students, probably it's because the stakes are higher, honestly. Like, I know I can have a look at past exams and I can identify exactly what it is that students need to know and exactly the way in which they need to communicate that information in order to get the marks from the examiner. And so a question which in year eight might just be like, explain blah, 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 or like, you know, answer this question. In year eight, a student can answer it and I'll be like, all right, they got the final answer. That's good. In year 12, I'm going to be like, here are the three things you need to do in this answer. And I'm going to model that. I'm going to break it down. I'm going to get you to practice a little bit. And then I'm going to get you to reflect upon it. I'm going to get you to like look at some exemplars and some non-examples and mark them. And then when the assessment comes around, I'm going to get you to reflect on your own assessment and give you the criteria again. I think effective teaching actually breaks it down more. An example of this is from Ballarat, Clarendon College, when I was there the other day. I saw the head of maths, Adele, teach year 12 maths methods class, which is like one of the more advanced math subjects. She was supporting them to go through one question. And I can't remember the exact question, but the first thing she asked them, they were on mini whiteboards, year 12 students, which is our final year of school. It was like, okay, draw a box in the bottom right corner and write the template for your answer. Like, what are you actually looking for in this question? And the students had to solve for A in terms of C and B in terms of C. And so initially what a lot of students wrote, because there were three unknowns, A, B, and C, initially what a lot of students wrote was like A equals B equals C equals, and she said like, chin it. And she was like, all right. And then she talked through it and then she was like, she gave them some hints and she said, have another go. And they went and, you know, lo and behold, most of the students then wrote, they were actually looking for only two unknowns, A and B, in terms of the third unknown, which was C. And so she did this she asked probably about five or six questions and got mini whiteboard responses. This was a retrieval. This was a retrieval question from a couple of weeks or months ago to ensure that they were actually set up for success with the question. And then she actually did line by line solutions on the mini whiteboard, checking that they were on the right track the whole way through and emphasizing what they needed to do to be successful and also doing cognitive modeling. So I think, you know, and then, you know, these kids get the highest results in the state. So I think that kind of, to me, the more you know about what students need to do to be successful in an exam, the more you can actually prepare to break something down in a really granular way. Now, I think there is an element of student independence that you can leverage and that you should ideally leverage, because another thing to think about is we need to scaffold these students to be successful in university. So they do need to be able to deal with, usually in most cases, pretty horrendous lecturing, right? Because they're probably not having teachers who listen to the Mr. Barton Maths podcast, unfortunately. Although I do know some lecturers who listen to this podcast. We need to kind of scaffold them towards that. And I know people like Tom Sherrington talk about using flipped learning and things like that in year 12, which I think can be super effective as well, because students have the motivation to actually consume some content at home. They can watch a video, rewind it, blah, 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 and then do more application in class. So I think those things are all options as well. But I don't think that means we should be, you know, breaking content down less or getting them to model, to copy down whilst the teacher's modeling, which is just a fundamentally inefficient thing to do. Or just, you know, assuming that mini whiteboards aren't needed or anything like that.
Yeah, it's interesting. As I say, it may just be, so my sample size here is significantly smaller than my sample size for seeing kids age 11 to 16. I see 10% of that number would be A-level lessons that I watch. So maybe it's a skewed sample. But it just seems to me, like you say, you've just got to be careful. The more complex the material, the more you need to break it down, the more you need to just make sure students know exactly what's going on. And I just think there's this notion that, all right, these kids are older, they've chosen to do maths, therefore they're independent. And I just think it's swayed a little bit too far that way. So just kind of a word of caution to myself more than anything.
Yeah, it's a good one to chat about.
All right, what have you got for us last?
This is a quick one, and I've been, I'm not sure if I've talked about it before, but we're running in Australia a thing called the Certificate in Coaching Leadership. It's like a 4-year program on how to be like a super effective instructional coach. And at the moment, I've been marking assignments. And the first assignments, people had to do like a drop-in, which is, you know, you pop into a classroom and you write some feedback to someone. And they had to submit their drop-in and then a commentary on it. And so it's been super interesting, like reading through people's drop-ins, and you know, I'm learning heaps, and also learning, you know, the things that I've done well, emphasizing, and the things that I need to like break down and model more, for example. But one like interesting thing I just picked up, because sometimes feedback's a little bit about tone, and I was like trying to work out why a couple of these particular drop-ins didn't come off as supportive as they potentially could have. And I've worked out that something we should try to do is we should avoid following praise with any of the words but, although, or however, right? Because like this is hopefully Chris Bolton level granularity here. But when you say something that's positive, and then you follow that with a but, an although, or an however, you signal that you're about to say something that's potentially not that positive, right? And so as soon as you use that kind of transitioning word, people are going to get their hackles up, in my opinion. And in reading these, I think, oh, what's coming next as soon as I hear one of those words? So, you know, I would encourage people to try to find ways around using those words. Just, you know, going straight into like, you know, one thing that I noticed, or something to potentially think about. Anything like that can be really helpful. In contrast, I actually found that using but, although, and however, following something that's more developmental or something to improve, is actually really helpful. So if you give some advice that's like, you know, this is something you might want to focus on in your lesson, however, these other parts were absolutely world class and it was an absolute privilege to be in your lesson, that's good, because you actually want to signal that it's the end of the developmental part, and you're kind of flipping the perspective of the comment from that point onwards. So it was just interesting noticing how people are using these three words. There's probably a few other kind of transitioning phrases that signal a change in perspective of the point of the person giving the feedback, and trying to like boil it down to go, you know, how can these words be used effectively in different contexts?
I love that. I love it. Love anything like that. That's brilliant. So a couple of things on this. Yeah, there's a real danger that coaching, and again, I'm going to use a swear word here, but listeners to our podcast, they love a bit of this. They love a bit of this. But if you've got kids, you're listening, you might want to dim it down. There's a real danger that coaching conversation could be a shit sandwich, right? Where you start off with something nice, then put in the big load of shit in the middle, and then have the nice bit at the end. And it's terrible, right? Because everyone's waiting for that big turd in the middle, you know, and you almost kind of don't listen to the good bit at the start and good bit at the end. So that, yeah, that's really nice. I'll tell you, I've got a stock phrase I use now, because again, we've talked about my coaching process and it's quite similar to yours, but it'll start with thanking the teacher for letting me in the lesson. I'll then ask them to tell me some good things they did and why they did it. And then I'll prompt praise following conversations with you and reading Josh's book, where I'll say, I really liked when you use mini whiteboards here. Why did you use mini whiteboards, and so on? And that's all really nice. But then everyone knows what's coming after the prompt praise. This is where we move into the kind of hypothesis, critical evidence. It's the area that they need to work on. So my kind of stock phrase now is, so let's imagine I'm coaching you and we've just done some, I've just prompted your praise and everything's going nice and you're dead happy. So then I just say, okay, here's the phase of the lesson I want to talk a little bit more about. And I think that's about as neutral as I can be without, because as you say, if I say, all right, that's great, but now let's look at this, they're like, oh God, here we go, they're ready for it. But if I just say, okay, because I don't want to sugarcoat it at the same time, because we've got some, you know, we want to work on. So yeah, I've just kind of almost instinctively just fallen upon this stock phrase of, okay, now here's the phase of the lesson I want to talk a little bit more about. And just by observing their body language, that doesn't seem to like make them contort in pain or like sit back or anything like that. So I think that's really nice. Final little bonus for you here, Ol. I've spotted, I put this in a Tips for Teachers newsletter, I think. I've spotted another word that I found myself saying in coaching conversations, and I've heard teachers say a lot, and I think it's a real problem. the word just. So just do this, we just do that. So like teachers modeling, so we just add two to both sides of the equation. And the problem with just, it's the same problem with like the word, oh, this is easy, this is simple. That if you don't find it easy or simple, you feel terrible about yourself and you're probably not going to put your hand up and tell the teacher. So that I think applies to coaching as well. If you just say something like, so all we need to do, we just need to get them to use mini whiteboards, or we just need to remember to do this. That is a real bad word to say. It's a real throwaway word. But if you'll find actually that that's quite complex and the coach has just said you just do it, you, again, you're feeling a bit crap about yourself and you're probably not going to voice up and say, actually, I'm not quite sure about that. So a few years ago, I eradicated easy and simple from my kind of vocabulary, but just is the new one that I'm trying to kind of push out there. So I just thought I'd throw that in as a little bonus for you there, Roll.
You just thought you'd throw it in, did you, Craig?
There you go. Very nice. Very nicely done.
No, I think that's a good one. I hadn't come across that one before. I think it's a really interesting one. And I will be looking out for the word just more in future as well.
Yeah. All right. Right. Last one for me is a quick one, Ol. And I don't know whether this is one of the best things I've ever seen or one of the worst things I've ever seen. So I'm going to let you be the judge of this, right? So I don't know if you remember a few episodes ago, we spoke about an idea that I'd had during the I do, we do phase of a lesson for giving kids a different question than their partner to have a go at. The reasoning being that with the you do, there's a particularly if it's on mini whiteboards, there's a chance kids copy off each other. And so we had a little conversation about that listeners can check out. Yeah, that's right. Well, I've seen another variant of I do, we do that I'd never seen before. I saw a teacher do it and my immediate reaction was, I'm not so sure about that. But then I thought, you know what, that could be really, really good. So I thought, Ollie Lovell's the man I need to pitch this to, right? So you've heard of an example problem pair, right? Can I interest you in a triple example problem pair? Right. So what this is, let's do a boring example first, right? Let's imagine that I want to teach the class how to add fractions together, add two fractions. They've never done it before, right? This isn't recap or anything like that. So traditionally what I would do, I'd have atomized beforehand. So kids would know about finding lowest common multiples, simplifying fractions and so on. And then I'd say to the kids, okay, I'm going to show you how to add these two fractions together. Empty hands, eyes on me, blah, blah, blah. And I'd check for listening and all that kind of thing. And then I'd give them a related question to have a go at on their mini whiteboards. And I'd probably give them a few related questions, you know, changing one thing each time and so on. Well, I saw a teacher, before she did that, she just said, here's a question, have a go at it on your mini whiteboards with the adding fractions. She phrased it as, I don't expect you to get this right. There's no pressure at all, but this will probably give me some really useful information about what I need to emphasize when I go through the process of how to do this. And the kids were like, fine, let's have a go. And, you know, half the kids didn't put anything down on the board. Some of the kids, you know, added the numerators and denominators, but some of the kids were starting to change those denominators round and so on. And when they held the boards up, again, she had some useful info. So she could, she probably could have predicted that some of the kids would have added the numerators and denominators, but because she had that explicit there, she could grab the boards and say, okay, right, so this is what we don't do and this is why and so on. So it was a pretty quick phase of the lesson. Let's say it took 2 minutes or something like that. It was really low stakes for the kids because of the way she'd framed it for them. And I can just see it potentially providing you with some really useful diagnostic information. I mean, one scenario is everyone can already do it, so you can just crack on, test them with a few other things. Or it may reveal a misconception that you'd not predicted. So perhaps for a less experienced teacher, it may give you some quite useful information there. I don't want the kind of potential lethal mutation from this is the kids who can already do it, you say to them, right, you don't need to listen to me now. You just crack on with this. I think that's a bit problematic. I'd rather still everybody be with me for that phase of the lesson. But I just thought maybe there's something in this that's worth kind of running by you. So triple example problem pair. What do you make of that?
Super interesting. So first thing is a grammatical one. I don't think it wouldn't be a pair anymore, would it? It would be a triple. A question, example, problem. triplet. But sorry, didn't
okay, make good. I like, well, let's rebrand that. That's good. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Look, I think it's really interesting, and it harks back to Kapoor's idea of productive failure in many ways. I think. I guess. I do have one specific comment, but quickly first wanted to ask, how did she actually, did she just circulate while students were doing that and try to get a sense, or were students doing it on their mini whiteboard and then
mini whiteboards? Yeah, it was mini whiteboards.
Could she realistically read multiple students' answers if they were chinning it? Like,
yeah, there was a data collection issue, but as I say, it was in this particular case, the fact that half of them put nothing kind of reduced that amount of data she had to take in a little bit. So she spent a bit of time looking and she grabbed a few of the boards as well. So yeah, I don't know how she could have reduced that amount of information in there, because it wasn't a final answer she was after. She wanted to see the process. But yeah, potentially she could have circulated maybe a little bit more effectively to get a bit more of that data in. Yeah, that's a fair point.
Yeah, I think circulation would, if you did that, circulation would be the primary tool for that data collection, because trying to read multiple answers of students who are, many of whom are probably doing some pretty wild stuff, would be questionable. That being said, like I had one particular class where I did this every single lesson.
Oh, wow.
And this was in my first year of teaching. I was teaching a VCAL class, which is the Victorian Certificate of Applied Learning. And it was like numeracy. And this was, you know, students. I had a range of students in this classroom. It was a year 12 class, I think. But, it, you know, it's more vocational maths. And I had some kids who would have been at, you know, grade 3 level probably. And some who were up at around the grade 10 level or so, maybe grade 9. But what I found is that they basically wouldn't listen to me if I went in and I was like, this is what we're learning today. Here's how to do it. What I had to do was be like, this is what we're learning today. See if you can do it. And they'd try and they'd be like, oh, I can't do that. And I'd be like, oh, you can't do it. Oh, well, let me show you. And then they would listen to me. It was just crazy. I don't know how I worked it out, but I think I just had it worked it out somehow one day. And then from then on, every lesson with that class, I would just start by showing the question, say, have a go, and then say, oh, you can't do it, and then do it. So there's kind of a motivational affective benefit to it as well, is what I found. So, you know, even if there is a data collection issue, I mean, I wasn't collecting any data then, apart from, you know, confused faces, which is what I knew was coming anyway. I think there's a motivational benefit anyway.
It's interesting. As I say, I can see my biggest reservation for this is, the kids who get it right, where's their incentive to listen to you then? Mm. And again, some teachers will argue, well, they shouldn't listen to you. They should crack on with other work. But I'm a little bit reluctant to do that, because I want to show them a clear method. I want to be making sure that they're listening to hopefully what's a clear and concise explanation from me and so on and so forth. So
yeah.
I just need to be a little bit careful with that. But I think it's certainly worth experimenting with.
It's a good point. And I think that motivational thing would work the opposite way for those kids who did get it right the first time. Because they'd be like, sir, exactly. I literally just did this. And now you're expecting me to sit here for like 3 minutes while you tell me how to do it. Like, what's going on there? So, yeah, probably goes both ways.
I think so. And I think you can help yourself a bit there by... certainly the way I do the it's a pretty quick process. I'm not involved in, I'm not asking a load of kids loads of questions or anything like that. So potentially it is only 90 seconds, as you say, 2 minutes tops. Whereas if it was like a 10-minute big discussion-based thing and they're sat there thinking, I already know how to do this, maybe you lose them there. But yeah, okay, that was good. That was good. Hey, so that brings us to the end of this. We're going to do the bonus. But one thing I forgot to flag up at the start, we've done a year of these now. This is our episode 12. And we committed to... a happy anniversary. We committed to 3 when I kind of sent you the email back in the day, and we've done a whole year's worth of these episodes. So I thought that was just worth acknowledging there.
That's great, mate. I'm glad, mate, I made the cut. I know there was someone else ahead of the line of me, and they were 3 people, and they all rejected your offer. So I'm glad I was 4th, and we're still here today.
There we go. Yeah, there we go. Who knows how long we'll continue, but we're still going strong. So, what have you got to plug before we end the main show?
Well, I'm looking forward to chatting with you about this bonus question about how you deal with criticism. And if people are keen to support the ERRR podcast and get access to the bonus question that we discuss every month, Craig, they might like to jump onto patreon.com/ERRR. But I've also recently come out with a new book, The Classroom Management Handbook with Dr. Mark Dowley, and it's had some great reviews on Amazon so far, and lots of people are enjoying engaging with that. And I've almost got the shipment here into Australia. I think it's about a week or two away. So if people are keen to get a copy of that in Australia earlier than would otherwise be possible, like, my website's the best place to grab that. You'll get it off my website earlier than Amazon, which you have to wait till June or so. And if you're in the UK, you can get it anytime. So if people are keen for some classroom management tips, they can jump on there.
Great stuff. So my usual plug is just my newsletters. Jump onto those. And you'll find some educational goodness in your inboxes every single week with that. One final thing I was going to say to you just before we wrap up the main one, all we're both reaching on the verge of some pretty important podcast anniversaries, you know. So you're not far off your 100th episode, and I'm not far off my 200th episode. So
rubbing,
yeah,
mate.
I might start. I've thought of a few ideas there, but yeah, just wondering if you've got any plans for the big 100. Is it best mate Dan Willingham coming on the show again?
It's a good point. Honestly, I haven't thought about it. The thing is, though, I do one a month, Craig. So the fact that I think I've just released 91 or something, so it's still almost a year till we get to my 100th. So I'm not sure how much we're approaching it. So I've got lots of time to plan. But thanks for reminding me, and I should definitely try to get some big dog. Maybe I'll try to resurrect Graham Nuttall for episode 100.
Try a real miracle.
Yeah, I'll upload all of Graham Nuttall's writings into AI and simulate a discussion with him. That would be pretty cool.
That would be a very good show. Very good. That's not actually the worst idea. That's very, very good. Love it. All right. Thank you, everybody, for keeping on tuning into these. We got some nice comments about these. So I'm really pleased people like these monthly chats. And we shall see you next month.
See you then, Tim.